This is Charitable Chit Chat with Kathy and Claire, the essential radio show for philanthropy professionals with Kathy Sheffield and Claire Meyerhoff.
Welcome to Charitable Chit Chat with Kathy and Claire. I'm Claire Meyerhoff.
And I'm Kathy Sheffield, and we have a fantastic episode called Good Gifts Gone Bad.
Ooh, that sounds so good and bad at the same time. And our special guest is a man who needs no introduction in the wonderful world of planned giving. He literally wrote the book on planned giving. It's a classic, The Art of Planned Giving. And he's written four other important books on philanthropy. Really, he's just one of the preeminent voices in our field today. This amazing person is the former director of Columbia University's Master of Science in Fundraising Management Program. And before that, he was academic director of New York University's Heyman Center for Philanthropy and Fundraising. Now, Kathy, based on these clues, are you able to guess who our special guest is?
You know, I'm just going to have to say, it's without a doubt, our guest can only be Doug White. Doug, thank you so much for being our guest on Charitable Chit Chat with Kathy and Claire. We are so happy that you are here with us today.
Well, thank you, both of you, Kathy and Claire. It's good to be with you.
Okay, Doug, give us a first really bad good gift gone bad.
Well, this is an example that most people have never heard of, but I like it because it is relatively small. We read about many gifts that are made that are very large, and some of them that have gone bad are very large. But I thought I'd begin or have the first example be something smaller, something that a lot of people can relate to. It's a $50,000 gift. And it was made by a couple by the name of Bernard and Jean Adler in New Jersey to a charity called SAVE, A Friend to Homeless Animals. So it wasn't some huge university. It was to a relatively small organization, a no-kill animal shelter. Now, they sued the organization because the money did not, as the donors were assured it would, go toward building new and spacious rooms for large dogs and older cats, animals that have difficulty being adopted. So instead, after SAVE merged with another charity, it decided to build a smaller facility than what had been advertised in the fundraising literature prior to the merger. So you have the Adlers looking at this campaign brochure and having a conversation with people at SAVE. They're saying, oh, you know, we could give $50,000 because we have in mind here a no-kill animal shelter for these specific kinds of animals. The charity came back and said, well, we've decided to build something smaller, and that facility would be one-tenth the size of what was originally proposed. And as it turns out, the space would be inadequate for the dogs and cats for whom the Adlers wanted to provide the money. So what happened was they gave the $50,000, and then the charity said, "Nah, we basically can't do that." And so they sued. And they said, look, if you're not going to do what we wanted and what you agreed to, and that's an important part of the equation, they agreed to this, then we are suing you for the $50,000 to get it back. That went back and forth in the courts for a little while. SAVE's, the charity's fundraising practices came into question when it abandoned the capital project altogether, no longer, of course, honoring the conditions of the gift, and then it refused to return the money. The attorney said, my clients received a letter explaining that SAVE was moving its facilities after the merger. When they contacted SAVE to learn more about what was going on, the response was not satisfactory. They met with the board. That still didn't go anywhere. In the world of gift agreements, there are two real components to deciding whether the charity is doing what it should with the money. And one is understanding, having a common understanding between donor and charity, what that purpose is. And the purpose here was to build a room. It was very specifically worded. So that first hurdle was passed. But the second was, are you doing it? SAVE came back and said, we couldn't do it. We didn't have the money to do it. That might sound like it was legitimate, but the idea here was that there was an agreement between the donor and the charity, and the charity did not do what it was supposed to do. So the judge said, so are you saying that my decision should be based on the financial stability or instability of this organization? The attorney for the plaintiffs then said, well, I appreciate there may be other economic issues involving SAVE. That's not why we're here today. We're here because my clients presented a particular program and an opportunity to fund a portion of that program. And SAVE is not following through with the program, and plaintiffs are requesting their money be returned. They donated the money on the basis of what was proposed to them, not on the basis of the strength or the lack thereof of SAVE. And the court sided on the value system of the donors, saying, we don't really care what your financial situation is. This is what you said you would do, and we're going to hold you to doing it. No ambiguity from the court's perspective that the charity had to honor the donor's wishes. So a lot of these things are not settled in court. They're settled out of court. But this was settled in court. So there is legal precedent, even though it's just one state, but there is legal precedent for donors to rely upon if they have a question with regard to their gifts.
It's pretty amazing how you walk us through that whole scenario. Kathy, what's your impression of this?
It's very unfortunate, obviously. I'm a firm believer that no charity ever wants to be sued, and no charity ever wants to have their name and reputation on the line, particularly in the context of not fulfilling a donor's intention or wishes. We treat our donors with the respect and an attempt to make good on everything that we follow up with them. And many times the donor does look to the development officer as the be-all, end-all. That relationship is so good that they will trust what the donor, what the development officer is saying. But unfortunately, sometimes the buck doesn't stop there, and other decisions are made that could potentially jeopardize that. I will say I'm intrigued by this case. I have not heard about this case, Doug, so I'm glad you brought this one up. But when you were talking about the Adlers and their gift, and you mentioned that it wasn't a very large gift, you know, I don't necessarily care how many zeros are behind the first number when it comes to a donor making a gift. The key is to make sure that the organization can handle what the donor is wanting them to do with their gift. And if they can't handle that, then at some point you have to make the decision not to accept a gift and to not jeopardize your reputation and your mission and your brand with that. It reminded me, though, you said this was a 2013 case. It reminded me of the 2005 case in Oklahoma with Garth Brooks.
Yes.
And that court awarded him punitive damages on top of on top of the gift. So and, you never A, want to put your brand, mission, name on the line for something like that. In particular with a celebrity that's gonna garnish more headlines, right?
Absolutely.
And
you're
so
right.
Many times that particular donor wishes to be, that donor in particular, Garth Brooks, always wants to be anonymous. So for him to have chosen to make this gift in honor of his mother, and he was willing to be named as the donor, which he rarely does, you're putting so much more on the line when you're accepting a gift like that, and then you choose not to fulfill it.
You couldn't have said it any better. I agree with you. And I mentioned this earlier, and I want to really emphasize this. The charity agreed to this. It's not just that the donor demanded it. Is that the charity agreed to this. So there was a mutuality involved here that the charity can't live and then walk away from.
That's the key right there. Why agree to something? Or Doug, actually, I'll say this. I actually worked for an organization in which we entered into multiple gift arrangements to build a program in a healthcare system that I worked for. I'll leave it very vague. And the system decided to move that from one entity to another. And it was here in the Metroplex. So you can imagine, with Fort Worth and Dallas being the way they are, you fundraise for, I can't remember if it was $17 million, whatever. And we had multiple donors pull their money together to come up with the $17 million. And then the system, at the end of the day, decided to move it over to Dallas. Well, that can pose a problem, right? So you have to communicate. You have gift agreements. That you're going to build this, and there's the written out and the assumption that it's going to be in Fort Worth, and then the system moves it. We had to communicate with every single one of those donors to let them know what the status was with regards to those gifts, and we actually had a couple donors request their funds back. And it's completely understandable. Well, of course, the system wanted to push back. The gift is no longer theirs. Public trust, public good. whatever. But we have a gift agreement, and we were fortunately able to convince the majority of the donors that the project merited their support, even though it was going to be relocated. But there were two large donors and very large gifts that we refunded just to save that relationship and to save the brand that was there. And sometimes you have to do that. You acquiesce and you say, we're so grateful for your support. We understand that you're not interested in moving that gift over to this entity. Thank you. But the key is communication and keeping them updated and making sure that they understand why it's in the best interest of the organization that the decision was made for whatever reason.
Again, so well said. And I'm so glad you were not only able to tell us that story, but also be a part of it. And charities have to understand that they're obligating future employees and boards to this decision. And this is where it really relates to any planned gift.
It's amazing to me, listening to this, and I have my public relations, communications, marketing person hat on. And when you work for a nonprofit organization in PR, there are so many things that can happen to you that create bad publicity, right? Like you have an after-school program, a bunch of kids get sick, fire at your dog shelter. There's all these things that happen that cause bad PR. But in this case, it's self-inflicted PR to me. And that is the scariest thing for a public relations person working for a nonprofit organization, when it's something that the organization does itself and it's self-inflicted. They bring it upon themselves. And I guess my question to you both as experts is, why don't charities realize that sooner? It's for this one animal shelter gift, it was $50,000, but why didn't they just give it back to the donor? Because the damage that you're doing to your brand is worth so much more than $50,000. So why is that? Why do they let it go so far?
Well, if you're asking me that question, I would respond by saying they didn't think they had the money and they thought they could use this phrase public good or public service as their defense. Hey, we're still doing good stuff for these poor animals. And so we're with you spiritually. And that was their argument. And I think they thought that would win the day.
I think pride is maybe not the right word, but the righteous good that they do overrides the principles behind the agreements that they've made. Even if they feel it's a handshake agreement, but in these both cases we've referenced, there was documentation. I don't know why charities don't take that preemptive strike, Claire, to save their reputation, save their name and brand for this $50,000 gift or whatever size gift it is. I think that they often think that they can do no wrong. And that's, in my mind, one of the things that I really struggle with about nonprofits. Nonprofits don't think of themselves as businesses. They think of themselves as some,
high-minded
I'm not being negative on nonprofits because good. We all know how much I love this industry and how much I love my profession and the good that these organizations do in our communities. But like Doug mentioned, that I think you called it escape clause. The escape clause is something that every single gift agreement instrument needs to save themselves. It's that CYA. It's what helps them. And you hope with everything in you that when you enter a gift agreement with a donor that you're able to fulfill their intention and their wishes. But you do need some kind of escape clause that allows you some leniency. And maybe it's not the charity will make every decision if the first one can't be fulfilled, but maybe it's something similar with a very similar intent or something that is that allows you to have some leeway with regards to whatever it was the commitment made, or what if it's a project, building, program, services, whatever it might be. You need to be able to fulfill it to the best of your ability. And I don't think not having the money is the right, that's not good.
It's a real breakdown in communication, because we always talk about donor intent and how hard would it be, I think, to go back to the donor and say, look, we've had some changes here, but we would like to use your gift as you want it used. What else would you like? like, here's a hamburger, here's some French fries. It's right. There's usually something else on the buffet. And you would think that they would be able, if these people had this intent, the Adlers, to make this $50,000 gift, they care. They obviously have charitable intent and they cared. How hard would it be to have gone back to them and said, look, we have an issue here. What else could we do with this gift that would make you happy? It's a real breakdown of communication and everything else as well. So let's move on to our second example. And Doug is so wonderful for bringing these examples to us because, as we mentioned in our intro, he's a writer and he spends a lot of time researching and talking to people to put together these amazing books that give us so many wonderful lessons in philanthropy. So Doug, let's move on to your second example of a gift gone wrong, gift gone bad.
The most important gift example here is the one made to Princeton, made in 1961, came from Marie and her husband, Robertson, in the form of A&P stock. She was an heiress of the A&P fortune. The A&P was a huge grocery store chain from the middle 1800s to fairly recently. So for well over 100 years, they were the grocery store chain in the United States, A&P being Atlantic and Pacific. And in 1961, she and her husband decided to make a gift of $35 million of that stock to Princeton. They established a foundation where Princeton was the only beneficiary. And so the assets in the foundation were considered by Princeton to be Princeton's. When they calculated their endowment value, they included that money. And the gift was established to endow the graduate program at what was then the Woodrow Wilson School of International Relations. It's no longer the Woodrow Wilson School, as you may have heard. Much at Princeton is no longer named after Woodrow Wilson for other reasons. But the idea was to endow the graduate program there so that the best and the brightest in the world could come. And basically, that's what happened. The program grew and it became extremely famous, selective. But in 2002, the children of the donor, the Robertsons, sued Princeton, basically saying they're not doing what they should with that money. And what Bill Robertson wanted to do was, as he said, divorce himself from Princeton. He wanted to take what was then, by then, 2002, remember it started out at $35 million, it grew to almost $900 million. That was after expenditures each year. And he wanted to take that, not for himself, but to put it into another university or some other universities where they would do what he said his father wanted. Princeton, like I said, they included that money as part of their own. And so to slice that off would be a terrible thing. And so they fought it tooth and nail. And they argued basically that we are doing what we should be doing with the money. We have established this great program. And some of the greatest people around the world are our graduates. So what's your problem? And he said, well, the problem is that you're not honoring my father's wishes. And it goes back to basically one phrase within this about 3 pages were really substantive to the gift. And the phrase is particular emphasis. And the idea was there would be a particular emphasis on putting graduates into government service in the international relations arena. Now, keep in mind that in 1961, the Peace Corps had just been established. There was this tremendous feeling about how great the United States was and how we could export democracy. And John F. Kennedy was the brand new young president. And the parents loved Kennedy, and they also loved Eisenhower, a Republican and a Democrat, because both wanted to export the ideals of democracy. And Princeton took on the gift. They accepted it. They were in the middle of a capital campaign. This was not part of the capital campaign, by the way, but they said $35 million. I mean, how can we say no? Yes, let's go for it. But the contention was that, first of all, that the money was spent in other parts of Princeton outside of the Woodrow Wilson School, and that not enough students went to not enough graduates went out to the world of public service. And Princeton argued the students did go to public service, but that unlike in 1961, there were a lot of nonprofits out in the world that are doing the kind of work that the United States government was also doing, and that should count. And this went on for 6.5 years, this argument went back and forth. And at the end of the day, it settled out of court. Princeton agreed to reimburse the Robertsons for the legal fees, as well as the Princeton fee was about $45 million as well. They paid their lawyers that. On top of that, they agreed to spend another $50 million to establish another nonprofit foundation that would be run by the Robertsons, and they could go do what they wanted to do and follow up what their father's wishes were. And then what was left of the foundation money would go into the Princeton endowment. The foundation would dissolve, and Princeton said that we'll continue to use the money to support the Woodrow Wilson School. A very messy ending, very sad ending. There were no winners in my view, but there was no clear cut answer either. You know, if there is a lesson to be learned, if not a finality to the legal decision, a lesson to be learned came when toward the end of the researching process, I asked Bill Robertson, you know, I've talked to you for hours and hours, tens, dozens of hours, Bill, is there a way this lawsuit could have been avoided? You've both spent, you know, together $100 million in legal fees and 6.5 years of your lives. What could have been done? And he said something that made me cry. He said, if they had respected me and my father more. Just repeating that moment makes me pause. If they would have respected me and my father more, it just, you know, this miles and miles and volumes of legal documents and heartache could have been avoided by just a little better stewardship, some respect. And it is true, Princeton did say, or one of the people at Princeton who wanted to be sure that I divorced his comments from Princeton's position, but the public relations officer, the chief PR person at Princeton said, well, we just think that Bill Robertson's a ne'er-do-well. He's got nothing else to do but sue us. I mean, I quoted him on that. And it was my practice to actually follow up on the quotes to make sure. I didn't want to do any gotcha. I wanted to make sure everybody held by their quotes, and they all did. And he did too. So they felt very strongly that he was just kind of wasting time. But the documents that I did find from the 70s, you know, 60s and 70s from the father proved and confirmed that the son was correct in his allegations.
You know, it's interesting, though, Doug, that you say they felt he was wasting their time, and that's just one person's opinion, right? Okay.
Right, yeah.
But it cost so much money on both sides for both parties to be wasting time. They both could have, well, I almost say they both could have, but you said proper stewardship would have taken care of this. Mr. Robertson said, if they had just respected me and my family more. It all goes back to, I believe, that people are rational. They have charitable intent. And as long as you're treating them and their families the right way, and if you have proper communication, you can resolve most of these issues without ever going as far down as some of these cases that we've talked about today get. Rational people lead most organizations, and donors typically are rational. And I think that proper communication and, as you said, stewardship can resolve most of these just by talking about what options are available. We've gotten ourselves in a pickle. We can't do this. We can't do that. But what could we do that would satisfy your gift, your intentions, your hopes?
Yeah. I think that is the fundamental lesson in all of this. And it is not a technical solution. It's not a legal solution. It's a human solution. And that's who we are in this profession. We're more human. As we talked before we started recording about how there's this tension in planned giving and in fundraising in general. What makes us successful is the human tendencies that we have. And it's not the legal background or the accounting background that drives us, but we have to have an understanding of that to really make us successful. But here, it was just so sad to see that all of this could have been avoided if only. Now, clearly this was some generations before, you know, 50 years. So different people are on stage. And that's the thing that if we take anything away from this moment right now, at this chit chat, is that we are obligating our successors to something. And we have to have that in mind. And there's nothing wrong with that, as long as it's rational. But in order to make that happen, it has to be worked. You can't just walk away from it saying, I've got the money. It is my firm opinion that most of the work that needs to be done in fundraising, whether it's planned giving or outright major giving or even, you know, annual giving, most of the work is not in the cultivation portion of it, but it's in the stewardship portion of it. The cultivation portion of it is fun. It's like dating. You know, you're getting to know someone, and that's the exciting part of the relationship. The stewardship part of it is like the marriage. It is as satisfying, but in a very different way, and it takes work. And this is where we were talking earlier about why charities, you know, don't fulfill their obligations. I think that's part of the mix. It's work. And we have the money in hand. Let's go find new money. And, you know, the better charities will spend a lot of time and money on thanking people and visiting people without saying, okay, I'm here because I want more money. I want to thank you for what you did do. And then you make sure your children are involved, as Princeton did. There's no question. The children were involved, but that's not always the case. But it's the bottom line here, for me anyway, is the stewardship part of the giving equation that is so important.
You know, one of the benefits of what we do, Doug, is that we sell ideals. We sell the ideal. We are not selling a Xerox copier or a home. We're selling and working with individuals who are okay having a financial transaction in exchange for some type of ideal. And I think we have the best jobs in the world. We have the best jobs in the world. And it's unfortunate that sometimes just as in any profession, there are bad apples that create these scenarios that we're talking about today. But at the end of the day, we still are in the best profession, and we're helping individuals create good in the world. And I hope, you know, my takeaway whenever I read any of these stories and some of the ones we've talked about today is, what can I do and what can my organization do to avoid these pitfalls and avoid getting ourselves in this type of situation? And that's what we want. We want to make the world a better place. However, our mission is doing that. And we hope to fulfill donors' intentions.
I think you're right, and I know you're right. At the time a gift is made, everybody has the best intentions, donor as well as charity. And I will also just throw out this quick thought. This won't be a whole story, but a quick thought. After the Princeton case, the Attorney General for New York, the head of the Charities Bureau at the Attorney General's office, Bill Robertson, said he wouldn't really write a gift agreement for less than 50 pages. He wants to have that much detail in it.
Wow.
As I mentioned before. Yeah. Well, he's an attorney, and he's an attorney, right? So, and he sees all the bad having in that job. He sees where charities go bad. So there's this case as we speak in Chicago. Well, it's in Oklahoma, but it's against the University of Chicago. It's a $100 million case. And that agreement is 60 pages, and it goes down to really a detailed budget going forward and all sorts of things. And still the two brothers are suing to get $20 million that they already paid and they back, and they want to be relieved of the other $80 million. Chicago's fighting it. It's in the court system right now. It was delayed by COVID, and I don't know where it's going to go. But the point I'm getting at is that I believe anyway, no agreement is going to be so perfect or so binding that you can foresee all future problems. What will be the magic sauce in that is what you just brought up. And that is the ongoing relationship with the donor and the donor's family. And without that, you could have a 1,500-page agreement, and you'd still find ways to find fault. So clearly, it's not the length of the agreement. The agreement has to be competent and probably should be more than 5 pages, the one at Princeton. But still, it's not the length of the agreement. It's the competency of the agreement and all the parties involved, but also the ongoing commitment of the organization to steward the gift.
So to bring it back to most of our listeners who work for smaller charities that aren't working on $100 million gifts with 60-page agreements, so, but what would be like a normal size agreement, Kathy? Not 60 pages, but 5 pages? How long? And what's in the agreement? Walk us through a little typical agreement.
Oh, wow. That's an interesting question, Claire, because I think it can go from a half a page to what Doug described as 60 pages. I think a good agreement covers who the parties are, what the gift is, what the donors want to do with the gift, what the organization is going to do with the gift, how it will be done, and then a signature. But most, what I will say, and I'm assuming Doug will agree with me, most organizations don't even do gift agreements. So, I mean, if we're talking about the majority of organizations, the small little shops with those $50,000 gift agreement or gifts like the Adlers made, most organizations don't even have gift agreements. The organization I'm working for currently before I got there didn't do gift agreements. And I will tell you that that's the majority of organizations in this country. So, things are done with handshakes. Things are done with a memo line on a check that says the gift will be used for this. And we all hope and pray that the right thing is done. And for the most part, I would guess that that's what happens. People in this field, both on both sides of writing the check, are good people and follow through on their intentions. But for these examples, my hope is that all organizations take heed and consider implementing gift agreements for all gifts over a certain size, whether it be $1,000, $5,000, $10,000, whatever that magical number is. That is not an annual gift or an unrestricted gift to an organization, that they consider some kind of documentation that takes into consideration what the donor wants and what the organization is going to do.
All this great practical advice from Kathy Sheffield. And now it's just time to wrap up. So I'd like to thank our guest. He is Doug White, one of the top names in the wonderful world of planned giving. And we're so happy that you could come on today, Doug. Thank you for being on Charitable Chit Chat with Kathy and Claire.
It's been my pleasure. And I love this profession. And I think back to what both of you said, and that is how fortunate we are to be in it. There are lots of ways to spend our lifetimes. And lots of people find happiness doing lots of things. So I'm not saying anything about any other path. But I think we three and the people who are listening to us and those others who are also in the world of planned giving and charitable giving and in nonprofits, even if they're not in the fundraising component of that, we are in a special place. I will always feel that way. And I feel just so grateful to have stumbled into this at a fairly early age, some many decades ago. And it's part of it is like being able to have this conversation with the two of you, but even larger, it's having a satisfaction that in our own ways, we're helping to make the world a better place.
Thank you, Doug White, for all you do, because we know nobody makes a vast fortune off of writing nonprofit books, right? So we know that is a labor of love.
The insomniacs among us will keep me going.
Doug, thank you so much for being on the show. And Kathy Sheffield, my wonderful co-hostess, it's always such a pleasure. I learned so much from you and from our guests. So thank you for listening to Charitable Chit Chat with Kathy and Claire. I'm Claire Meyerhoff.
And I'm Kathy Sheffield.
And remember, Charitable Chit Chat with Kathy and Claire is much more than a podcast.
We're your friends in planned giving.
Thank you for listening to Charitable Chit Chat with Kathy and Claire. You can connect with Kathy Sheffield and Claire Meyerhoff on LinkedIn and learn more by visiting charitablechitchat.com.